Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello, welcome to an hour of mind power. Well, sit back, relax, because we're going to be talking poetry this afternoon, and maybe poetry has never been something that has grabbed your mind, your imagination, but all of us are affected by it on so many different levels, and I have a delightful guest, Ted Kooser. He's a presidential professor of the University of Nebraska, a former U.S. poet laureate, and also winner of the Pulitzer Prize in Poetry. He's written a whole bunch, but I have two of his books with me. One's called Valentine's Poems, and the other one is The Poetry Home Repair Manual. Both of them are awesome. Ted, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Donna. It's nice to be talking with you.
When I first received your material, because I've gotten material from other poets, I thought, gee whiz, I wonder what this is going to be all about. And as it turned out, because of your scheduling, we weren't able to have you on a Valentine's Day, and I just fell in love with your book, Valentine's Poems. It's
absolutely awesome.
And then when I learned that you also had a manual that you had put together on how to write poetry, I said, boy, I got to find out more about this. You are an incredible writer. You're just absolutely marvelous.
Thank you.
And I'm going to read one of your poems. I'm going to bounce around in your little book, the Valentine's book. It says, "Oh, mariachi me." It said, "All my life I've wanted nothing so much as the love of women. For them I have fashioned the myth of myself, the singing troubadour with the flashing eyes. Always for them my black sombrero with its swinging tassels, this vest embroidered with hearts, these trousers with silver studs down the seams. Oh, I am mariachi me as I had intended. I am success and the price of success. Now old and dusty at the edge of the dance floor, still smiling, heavy with hope, clutching my dead guitar." You have such a way with words. It's just amazing. And when I had read through the Valentine's poem, then I received your other book, The Poetry Home Repair Manual, I went to a poet job's description, and I had to laugh, because the third sentence in the book is, "You'll never be able to make a living writing poems. We better get the money business out of the way before we go any further. I don't want you to have any illusions." And that made me laugh, but it's true.
It's absolutely true, yeah.
Tell us what spoke to your heart and your mind and why you evolved into this arena of writing, because poetry is challenging.
Well, I started when I was quite a little boy. I remember having a particularly encouraging teacher when I was in the fourth grade. She had us write some poems, and of course my mother kept them. I had them around for years. I've successfully hidden them away now, but when I got to be a teenager, I really had very little going for me. I had no athletic ability. I couldn't play a musical instrument and so on. And yet it was very important to me, and I think this is important for a lot of adolescents. I wanted to be attractive and mysterious and different and so on. And I was living in my hometown of Ames, Iowa, which was a very white bread sort of place, you know, in many ways, and I wanted to differentiate myself from that. This was in the Eisenhower years, and I somehow or other came upon poetry as being something that would really set me apart from everyone else, and so in a very single-minded way, I threw myself into it, and I wrote hundreds of poems for my high school sweetheart, and fortunately, when we broke up, I was told by one of our friends that she had burned them all in a ditch by the side of the road. And then And then here not too long ago, we had our 50th high school reunion, and I was unable to go, but shortly before that, I was talking to one of my old friends, and he said, you know, she says she still has some of those poems. And I thought, oh, God. But I like a lot of young people, I took on the identity of a poet before I was very good at writing poems. You know, I wanted to look like a poet. I wanted to act like a poet. And I see this among young people a lot. You know, you get the costume right first, and then the poetry or the painting comes second, you know.
You touch on so many different poems, and you make little comments, because I think there is that special something inside of someone when they're wanting to write and express themselves. And you said when it comes to poetry, there really are no rules. Explain that, because almost anybody I've ever met felt like they had to follow a certain formula.
Well, I think that's because poetry has been taught, I think wrongly, generally, for a long time. And one high school teacher would teach, or junior high teacher would teach someone, and they would go on to be a teacher, and they would teach the same way and everything. And that was with the idea that a poem was a kind of problem that needed to be solved, and it had an answer, which was the meaning, and so on. And so we all, came up with the idea that a poem, had certain rules about it, that it was a problem, and if you got the meaning right, you were okay. If you got it wrong, you flunked, and that sort of thing. And rather than it being something of pleasure and useful as a means of expression or communication with other people, and I'm not saying that all teachers were that way. Of course, there were some really good ones, of course, and I've met a lot of very good high school English teachers over the years, but generally, it was not a pleasant experience for people to be studying poetry in junior high and high school, and part of that was the emphasis on form, that a sonnet had to be in a certain way and all that. It's okay to study literature that way, I think, to teach people, and because it is important to be able to understand literary forms and so on. But we also need to teach the pleasures of poetry and the delight and charm of it and so on, that in such a way that people will go on and be lifelong poetry readers, rather than what happens is because of having a bad experience trying to learn poetry in the traditional way, people get out of school and they never look at another poem again because it was such an unpleasant experience.
Mm-hmm. That's true. That's very true. You also mention how solitude is very important with writing, and I agree with that. I think that there is a magic in solitude where you don't have anything or anyone pulling on your mind. And your words, you have such a wonderful way with words. You say, writing can be an exhilarating work while you sit quietly scribbling into your notebook. Memories and associations rise like bubbles out of the thick mud of your mind. When did you find you became comfortable with the visuals that you would see and the words you would use to express the emotion and the picture of what you wanted to convey with the black ink on the white page?
Well, Donna, I'm never quite comfortable with it. I mean, it never gets easy for me. I write every morning from about 4:30 in the morning till about 7 o'clock, and 28 or 29 days out of the month, I fail miserably at doing it well. If I were not sitting there on the one day that a better one happens to me, I wouldn't get it at all. So, it's very important, and I think it's true in all the arts. It's important to show up for work.
Yes.
But I write poorly most of the time. If you were just looking at the calendar, so it is a challenge. And I worked on a poem this morning that I actually started yesterday and worked on it all morning, and I it's still a failure. I don't know how to pull it out of that. But but perhaps tomorrow morning there'll be one that works better, you know. So it's just a matter of discipline and so on.
You talk about trusting the impulses. And I think when someone is trying to write, especially with poetry, you need to allow it to be all right to just put down whatever you feel like putting down. Like you said, it may be trash as far as you're concerned, but you never know how that is going to come to life. You just don't know what's going to bring that mental peak in there.
That's right. And you may be wrong about it on your first assessment. You know, this poem that I worked on today that that I don't like too much, you know, tomorrow morning I can look at it again and with fresh eyes, and it there may be some virtues to it that I hadn't even thought about. So time is really extremely important, you know, giving your work time to so that you can see it from some point of detachment and look at it as if it were someone else's work, which I think that's very important too. But as far as trusting the impulses, I think, as you suggest, that we ought to get the first part of the first draft of the poem down as loosely and as fully as possible and get it all there on the page and then start picking away at it.
I liked what you said about an individual not having to have an IQ of 160 to write a good poem.
Well, yeah, I have no idea what my IQ is, but it's my working vocabulary is quite small, I think. You know, I don't consider myself to be a particularly bright man. I was pretty much an average student all through school. You know, I got good grades in English and art, but generally I was pretty much a C student. We get the idea, again, of this from traditional teaching methods in which, you know, we had to look at John Milton's Paradise Lost and talk about the enormous ideas behind it and so on. And, you know, and Milton did have apparently a titanic intellect, you know, but I don't consider myself, you know, to be an extremely bright man.
Well, let me share one of your poems, and this one really touched my heart. It's called Splitting an Order. I like to watch an old man cutting a sandwich in half, maybe an ordinary cold roast beef on whole wheat bread, no pickles or onions, keeping his shaky hands steady by placing his forearms firm on the edge of the table and using both hands, the left to hold the sandwich in place, and the right to cut it surely, corner to corner, observing his progress through glasses that moments before he wiped with his napkin, and then to see him lift half onto the extra plate that he had asked the server to bring, and then to wait, offering the plate to his wife while she slowly unrolls her napkin and places her spoon, her knife, and her fork in their proper places, then smooths the starched white napkin over her knees and meets his eyes and holds out both old hands to him. That touched my heart so deeply. You have such a gift with words. You tell the story of an affection between two people that in my mind feel when I'm reading it, they've been together a long time and they don't have to talk. They just do,
yeah.
And her reaching out to him is an expression of love and appreciation. And you conveyed it in that very short space with such a vividness and with such a feeling. It cannot be lost. It cannot be ignored. It's beautiful.
Well, thank you very much. Of the poems in the Valentine book, that's certainly one of my favorites. For several reasons, I like to write about the ordinary. There's nothing as ordinary as watching a couple in a restaurant splitting an order. You see it all the time. I would guess that everybody who's listening to us today has seen somebody do that. But I wanted to really focus on it and see what I could bring out of that. And, you know, there's a key word in that poem. I didn't notice it when I wrote it, but a good friend of mine here, a retired professor from the English department, Robert Noel, pointed out, he said, you know, that whole poem hangs on one word in the last line, and that's old. She holds out both old hands to him.
Mm-hmm.
He said without the word old in there, the poem would not work nearly as well. And I thought that was very interesting that he observed that. But I think he's really true, because and it feeds into what you just said, you know, that these people have been together for a long time. But, yes, I like that. I also should say that my favorite point of view as a poet is to be observing something from some distance away so that I am not intruding into the scene as the writer. Occasionally I appear in my own poems, but generally I prefer to be watching something and simply reporting on it, as it were.
You say a poem is the invited guest of its reader, and that no poem has ever entered a reader's life without an invitation. No poem has the power to force the door open. No one is going to read your poem just because it's there.
That's right.
Poetry, I can't say that it's out of favor, but dependent on the writer, many times it will not grab you. And you'll just put it aside, and maybe it's a time in your life where poetry is the last thing, like you said, because of what you've gone through in school or some frivolous stuff maybe you've read. But your poetry has such depth to it that does portray the common experience with a view that a person feels like they have a privilege of being able to see that experience as you see it. It's quite a gift.
Well, thank you. I've been at this for 50 years. I have been pretty much writing about and thinking about poetry some part of every day for all those years, you know, so it's a skill. I have, you know, polished it, and we certainly hope we get better at everything we do. I've told people before that if I had taken up longbow archery, and put as much time in it as I put into poetry, at 100 yards I could put 200 arrows in a paper plate by now, you know. So part of it is just lots and lots of experience writing, and also thinking about the person at the other end, the person who is reading the poem. What might their expectations be? What might you be offering them for their lives? Now, when you mention that, you know, sometimes a poem does not grab you, well, you know, I think that can happen with very good poets. I find, you know, if I look at a new book of poems by someone, that generally most of the poems in the book do not grab me as such. But if two or three in a book really move me in some way, I tend to look at that as a pretty good book. For me, you know, a good experience. Poetry is such that, you know, it would be a rare thing for a person to fall upon a book and love everything in it. So, you know, and if a poet, frankly, can write a half dozen poems in a lifetime that last 100 years, that's really quite an accomplishment.
When you are wanting to write, and I know many of my listeners have a desire maybe to publish a book, and maybe they have had their own kind of love affair with poetry, and they would like to express themselves. So frequently, people, when they have the desire to write, they're very self-critical. And I love what you put in your book. You talk about essential details with poetry, no spare parts, but you also made a comment that I was surprised with. It makes sense, but it surprised me. You say, sometimes after you've written a poem, you try to revise it, and you turn the poem upside down. You put the last lines first just to see if it improves it. You said you may like a poem a little better when it's standing on its head like that.
Well, that's true, yeah.
And I mean, that's such a visual right there. The poem standing on its head.
Yeah.
I mean, and that can be done, you know, that is really a significant statement there. How many of you stood on their head?
Oh, I often move the stanzas around to see. What happens is that when we start a poem, we write with such intensity that, and then we may relax a little as it goes, and so that the opening lines are the most, are the richest, and you don't want the poem to sort of deteriorate in that way and lose its energy. So sometimes by putting the top stanza on the bottom, you know, you can improve it. That's an idea that I stole from another poet, John Knoefel, who apparently taught that way, students that way, a number of years ago, and I heard about it secondhand, but it made great sense to me.
You have a poem by Emily Dickinson that you used. You said it's her reflection in the glass. It's so vivid. And this is how it read: "It's all I have to bring today, this and my heart beside, this and my heart and all the fields and all the meadows wide. Be sure you count should I forget someone, the sum could tell, this and my heart and all the bees which in the clover dwell." Emily Dickinson is dearly loved, and she's been loved by generations of people. Why was it that she was so significant to you?
Well, there are many Emily Dickinson poems that, and again, this is, you know, reiterating what I said a moment ago, there are many Emily Dickinson poems that really don't do much for me. You know, they seem to be very competent, well-made poems, and, you know, I'm sure that there are others who would be more directly affected by them. But there are some poems by Emily Dickinson that I'm particularly fond of. I was thinking the other day about, we're having full-blown spring here in Nebraska right now. All the flowers are in, or the trees are in bloom, the red buds and the pears and so on. And there's that Dickinson line that came into my head that I really dearly love, where she says, and I hope I'm quoting it exactly, "The farmer turns the drunken bee out of the foxglove's door." You know, that the idea of spring being that, you know, mm-hmm. that the farmer's out there plowing and plowing into the foxgloves, and the drunken bees have to leave, you know. That she's very good with that kind of very close attention to things. But again, you know, I would have difficulty, you know, thinking of more than a half dozen of Dickinson's poems, you know, that I'm, you know, completely dedicated to. But just think of all, and she wrote so many, I mean, you know.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
And again, she's loved by so many people even today. You suggest doing something that I think is a great idea, and that is when a person is writing material, writing poetry, that you suggest that whatever the draft is, you read it out loud so that you can hear it.
Oh, yes.
And I thought that is really a super thing to do.
Well, poetry really is, you know, it's partly sense, but it's also very much sound. And give you an example of something. My wife, to whom I've been married for 30 years, learned to read during the Kennedy years, and at that time there was a great deal of emphasis on speed reading. And in speed reading, as I understand it, words represent ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And so she would read for the ideas and not hear the words in her head as she read them. Shortly after we got together, I, you know, was reading her some poems one evening, and she said that she suddenly understood something about poetry, because now that she had heard it out loud, you know. Because if you read for the ideas, then you miss a great deal of the music of a poem, the alliteration, the rhyme, you know, all those things
mm-hmm.
are parts of the auditory experience. And I am fortunate, and I would guess others of my generation, I'm now 69 years old, in that I was taught to read in such a way that we actually hear the words. I can't read a novel any more quickly than I could read it if I were reading it aloud, because I, you know, all the words, I have to sort of say them to myself.
Mm-hmm.
And that's helped me immeasurably as a poet.
You say we're open to taking a short safari into the country of memory, and we should write what we feel, and we just need to make it okay to put things down, because, as you stated, poetry would be a lost art if there were laws against writing about feelings, and the poetry cops would be very busy pounding on poets with nightsticks.
Mm-hmm.
Again, your use of words is just so very, very good. And obviously this is a love of your life, because you've put so much of your life into it. When you are talking to students and people that would like to do this, yearn to do this, what is the strongest bit of wisdom that you give to them?
Well, I think the most important thing is to read poetry. We learn so much from reading. I work with graduate students at the University of Nebraska, take a few of them each fall and work with them privately. Each one comes and we sit in my office for an hour a week and talk about what they're doing. And I encourage them to read 100 poems for every one they try to write. Now, knowing graduate students as I do, I know they're not going to read 100 for every one they try to write, but it's a good idea. Because, you know, we learn from every poem. The ones that we really detest, we learn things from. We learn things from the ones that we adore. We see poets making, you know, rather clumsy errors, and we learn from that. And so on. So that's how you learn the art, is by reading poetry. It's extremely important. I am basically a self-taught poet, and my self-education is all based upon lots and lots of reading of poetry over the years. You know, I don't have a master in fine arts in poetry. I had one creative writing class as an undergraduate, and another one when I was a graduate student, and so on. So I'm not a trained creative writer in that sense, but I was able to teach myself about poetry by reading it.
Well, I think that reading is so important, and I think when you can read poetry and allow that you're taking the opportunity to see the world through someone else's eyes and to recognize the play of words, the descriptions, how the words paint pictures in someone's mind, it really is a wonderful, wonderful thing to do. I want to share one of your poems. It's called Tracks. Using a cobbler's shoe last, I found one summer at a yard sale, and the heavy leather uppers from cast-off boots, a jigsaw, some wood, an awl and thread, and a few evenings sitting alone thinking of you. I've fashioned a pair of red Valentine shoes with heart-shaped wooden heels. Look for my tracks on your doorstep where I stood with sore feet through the evening, too timid to knock. That is wonderful. It's delightful.
Thank you.
Ted, do you have a website that people can go to?
There is a website, tedkuser.com, that is run by the University of Nebraska system. I haven't looked at it recently. It does not have a calendar of things I'm doing or so on. I haven't been able to ask them to do that sort of thing, but there's a good deal of information about me on there, and I believe there are some audio and video clips and that kind of thing.
Well, Ted, it's been a delight having you as a guest. Thank you so much for sharing with us today your beautiful poetry. For those of you listening, his wonderful book, Valentine's Poems. Also, the Poetry Home Repair Manual, and he's written other things as well. So you can go to tedkooser.com. That's Ted, KOOS. Ted, again, thank you so much for being my guest.
Thank you, Donna. I've enjoyed it.
It's been delightful. We're going to be taking a break. Don't go away now. We'll be right back.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Hello, this is Dr. Richard Petty, the author of Healing, Meaning, and Purpose, and creator of the RichardGPettyND.com website. I am thrilled and delighted to tell you that starting February 7th, 2008, at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, I'm going to be joining my friend Donna Sebo on her show on bbsradio.com. We're going to do this every month, and I can guarantee you that we're going to be sharing new information and new concepts that will astonish and inspire you. Hello, this is Dr. Richard Petty, the author of Healing, Meaning, and Purpose, and creator of the RichardGPettyND.com website. I am thrilled and delighted to tell you that starting February 7th, 2008, at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, I'm going to be joining my friend Donna Sebo on her show on bbsradio.com. We're going to do this every month, and I can guarantee you that we're going to be sharing new information and new concepts that will astonish and inspire you.
Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Telephone lines are now open. Give me a call if you'd like to let me light up your life with a little bit of insight. Here are the toll-free numbers, 877-876-5227. That's 877-876-5227. Canadians, 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. And also our direct line of 530-876-3222. It's 530-876-3222. That's all you need. When you call in, I just need your first name or your initial. If you're a first-time listener, welcome. We're delighted to have you with us. And then let me do my thing. Let me show you how I utilize my mind skills. I'm an information resource. And then you're welcome to ask me about anything that you like. Oh, by the way, I wanted to share some items with you that I didn't have an opportunity to do on Friday. So here we are. I thought I would just love to tell you how grateful we should be with what's going on in our lives today. Do you know that shock therapy was really the in thing in Victorian England? I haven't ever figured out why they haven't totally made it obsolete and obliterated it, but they haven't. Now, Victorian England was obsessed with the idea of a sound mind and a healthy body. Does that sound familiar? Especially the letter. Now, health gadgets, well, they had all kinds of little goodies that people came up with, and most of them were harmless. Now, girls that had real prominent ears, they wore what's called Claxton's ear cap as they slept, as if that's going to make any difference. And rheumatic sufferers underwent excruciating treatments on Zander's mechanical exercises. Boy, you think that this exercise stuff is new? Mm-mm. People have been doing it for a long time. You know that adults that were rather sedentary, does that sound rather modern? They bought mechanical horses that simulated riding, and they even came, ladies, you're going to love this, they came with side saddles. Can you imagine sitting that in your parlor in Victorian England? Riding side saddle? Oh, boy, doesn't that sound like fun. Now, one of the oddest inventions was Mr. B. Harness's electropathic belt. Yes, doesn't that sound exciting? This battery-operated appliance, strapped around your midriff, it would deliver a series of mild electric shocks. Now, the advertisement regarding this unique item proclaimed that the belt acts upon all the organs of the body, rarely failing to alleviate most of the disorders resulting from local or general debility. It also could improve the figure and prevent chills, not to mention that it renewed exhausted nerve form and cured hysteria. Oh, boy. But in the one thing it could not do was survive in the face of advancing medical technology. You know, with some of these exercise machines out there, have we really advanced any? And hysteria. Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Okay, we're not passing out because we don't wear the corsets anymore, ladies. But trust me, the idea of the figure and the form and good health and all of this, it's nothing new. Fortunately, we have some other options. I don't think I would be too excited about mechanical horses with side saddles in my living room or any place else. Anyway, that just should make us appreciate what we have achieved and accomplished. Of course, my husband has an attitude about exercise. He said, whenever the urge to exercise hits him, he always sits down until it passes. Yes. Well, I know that you're not going to go along with that. Donna Sebo here. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 877-876-5227 or 888-815-9756 for Canadians. Also 530-876-3222. By the way, don't forget, on June the 9th, I'm going to be doing a program in Spain, and you will be able to hear it via the Internet if you'll go to www.rem.fm.com. This is the largest English-speaking station in Europe, and I've been invited to be a guest there. So that's going to be at 5:20 in the morning. Don't worry, you won't have to set your alarm, because you'll be able to listen on the archive. They have that up on the Internet, just like we do. So you'll be able to hear the interview there. The power of the mind, the ability of the mind, oh, it's fascinated human beings from as far as we've ever known. Why? Because typically those individuals that had the sight, I used that terminology with someone just last week, and they said, what are you talking about, the sight? Well, that was common terminology at a certain time in history. It meant that you were clairvoyant, clairsentient, clairaudient, whatever, clair-whatever you wanted to declare yourself about having. Then that's what it related to. Well, there was a man called Andrew Jackson Davis. Nope, not Andrew Jackson of the fame of the United States, being the president. Nope, not at all. Andrew Jackson Davis was the son of a very poor shoemaker. The shoemaker also was an alcoholic. And he had virtually no education, and for his entire life, pretty much, did menial work. Yet, his mother, who was considered a visionary, he got the gift from her and inherited a clairvoyant talent that marks him as an outstanding soothsayer. You know that he foretold the coming of both the airplane and the car, and this is the time frame. Sometime before 1842, his family had moved to Poughkeepsie, New York. And there he met a man, William Levinston, who was a journeyman tailor and an amateur mesmerist. Now, Levinston recognized Andrew Jackson Davis's abilities. He thought they were very rare, that he was clairvoyant. And when he was working with him, he promoted him initially as a traveling faith healer. Now, Davis gave more than 150 lectures in Manhattan, most of them in a state of trance, and he also wrote a number of books. Now, he made prophetic statements that achieved a startling degree of accuracy and detail. He is said to have predicted prefabricated concrete buildings. He wrote a book in 1856 called Penetralia, P-E-N-E-T-R-A-L-I-A, for those of you that might be interested in looking it up on the Internet. In that book, he wrote of aerial cars, which will move through the sky from country to country. He also predicted the internal combustion engine and the automobile in this very same book. He called them carriages and traveling saloons on country roads, without horses, without steam, without any visible power, moving with greater speed and safety than at the time that he was writing this. He said, carriages will be moved by a strange and beautiful and simple admixture of aqueous and atmospheric gases, so easily condensed, so simply ignited, and so imported by a machine, somewhat resembling our engines, as to be entirely concealed and manageable between the forward wheels. These vehicles will prevent any embarrassments now experienced by persons living in thinly populated territories. The first requisite for these land locomotives will be good roads upon which, with your engines, without your horses, you may travel with great rapidity. In 1856, he wrote about this. Now, if you've ever had an experience where you've had a dream or there's just been something that's popped into your head and it's come to pass with such clarity and you go, whoa, this is strange. Or if ever you've talked to someone, say a psychic, and they have predicted something for you and you find that it's right down to the button in accuracy, you go, how'd they do that? Well, the only way I know how to explain it is that there's no time or space with mind. Projections evolve because of thoughts. When Andrew Jackson Davis was in this altered state of mind, there was nothing of his conscious mind that was saying, you can't say this, you can't say that. There were no parameters of limitation drawn about the mind. There are patternings of thought that go way, way in advance of what people would ever seemingly imagine. But stop and think of what he said about flying cars. Flying cars. How many of us have watched the Jetsons through the years? That was science fiction, right? Or just cartoon time. Someone was using the imagination. Anything that can be thought of can evolve. We are very close to being able to run a vehicle on water. In fact, technology has been around for a long time. There was a gentleman featured just within the past few months on Fox 13 who has an engine. He took an old car, converted the engine, is running it on water. He's gone public with it. This is happening. Why? Because of necessity. We are finding we have to think differently about things. So a lot of ideas, a lot of concepts that are there, that are available, we begin to tap into them. This man, long before anything like this was available, was able to tap into that probability patterning. And one of the things about us as individuals that we have is choice. And there was some great person, I'm trying to think of who it was, I think it was Socrates, who was taken to an oracle when he was very young, and they said that with all of his talents, that he could become the greatest criminal in the world, or he could become the greatest teacher. And he decided on his own that he didn't want to be the criminal, and he became known throughout history, and is still quoted today. You have these stories. You have these moments where you make choices. Those choices enable you then to sort of design your own probability patterning and ensure your success. But again, the choices are yours. Are we going to have vehicles that run on a self-made form of energy, a self-reproducing type of energy? Absolutely. It's going to be just a given. Are we going to be able to have those little body scanners like they showed in Star Trek so many years ago? Of course. The reason being is that once an idea is stimulated, the mind of the individual will grasp onto it and work with it and say, how can we make this happen? What is the possibility? Look at the Internet. Who would have envisioned it doing what it's doing today, and we haven't even scratched the surface? Got a wonderful world we live in. But remember, you are a creator too. You're just not here to be a puppet on the end of strings going nowhere. You're meant to be a productive person that's going to make a difference in life. This is Donna Sebo. We're going to take a break. Hey, phone lines are open. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 877-876-5227. Canadians, 888-815-9756, also 530-876-3222. We're coming back in just a moment.
Do you want to lose weight? Do you deal with diabetes, high blood pressure, osteoporosis, or chronic pain? Do you want to know one of Dr. Perricone's 7 secrets to beauty, health, and longevity? Do you have 15 minutes a day to look and feel better? Then let me introduce you to TTAP, the workout that works. For the beginner or expert exerciser, learn from physical training specialist Teresa Tapp how, in just 15 minutes a day, you can burn fat and sugar, build strong bones and muscles, and lose inches fast with no equipment or jumping. Visit the TTAP website, ttap.com, or call 1-800-342-0717 to learn how. That's TTAPP.com. We'll help you lose inches, look good, and feel fabulous.
Enter the magical world of God's kiss.
Johnny finds himself at the entrance to a large open valley, framed by high mountains rich in the brown-red colors of the earth. He stands in awe, even a little fearful of the mountain's great size. After all, he's just a little boy and not very tall.
God's Kiss is a beautifully illustrated children's book about a young boy's journey into a valley with children and animals from all over the world. They are gathering together to experience the wonder of love and beauty that will affect their lives forever. A talking book audio narrated by the author Donna Sebo accompanies this wonderful storybook, creating a special magic all of its own. This book package makes a wonderful gift for those special children in your life ages 3 to 10. God's Kiss book and talking book audio are only $19.95 plus shipping and handling, and the author Donna Sebo will autograph and personalize your book if you request it. Call 800-872-8852. You can also order through Donna Sebo's website, www.delphiinternational.com.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious foods? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature, however, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Hi, this is Donna. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat, 877-876-5227, or Canadians, 888-815-9756, also 530-876-3222. Tomorrow, we're going to teach you how to outswim the sharks. Mm-hmm. We've all encountered a few of those. One time or another, Ruth Schwartz-Hebron is going to be my guest. And then we're going to be talking with Dr. Shepard Colmenares, Right for Life. This book is so special because it talks about journaling and the difference that it can make in your life. It has been a big part of mine for so many, many years. And, oh, when I don't do it for a while, I find it so refreshing when I get back to it because it helps me to keep clarity and to stay focused. Also, we're going to be talking about math for mystics. Aha. Are you a mystic? Do you like math? Well, Rena Sesso is going to be my guest. And Dr. Richard Petty, we've rescheduled him for Memorial Day because he has been called out for a speaking engagement. So we may have an open mic on Friday. Regardless, give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. And also make note of the guests that are coming up. And you can check at bbsradio.com. My listings are there. Also, you can check on my website. If you'd like to get my email newsletter, you're going to be able to do that. All you have to do is send me an email to Donna at DelphiInternational.com. and we will put you right there on the newsletter list. Otherwise, you can go right to my website, download it for free, and read it as you would like to whenever that's comfortable. I wanted to share some points of information. So often I am aware of conversations with people and with families who have teenagers, and I thought I would share this information with you because any and all of us that have ever had teenagers, one of the biggest concerns we have is their sexual involvement. We want to be alert and aware. We want to educate them, and sometimes we wonder if it's falling on deaf ears. Well, let me tell you, research has shown that the sexual education does pay off. Most teens who receive sex education before becoming sexually active are more likely to delay the physical activity and to use contraceptives when they do finally have sex. Now, there's a study that was done in January 2008 issue of the Journal of Adolescent Health. The researchers at the Center for Disease Control and Prevention examined data that had been collected from 2019 unmarried youths ages 15 to 19. This was collected by the 2002 National Survey of Family Growth. Now, sex education reduced by two-thirds the percentage of boys who had intercourse before the age of 15 and more than half of the percentage of girls who had done so. Male teens who attended or graduated high school were 2.77 times more likely to use birth control the first time they had physical intimacy if they had received sex education. Now, they found that sex education was not linked to contraceptive use in female teens, but proved particularly important for at-risk subgroups, such as female African Americans. And this is what they said. Sex education provides youth with the knowledge and skill to make healthy and informed decisions about sexual activity. The study did not differentiate between self-education programs that teach contraception and those that teach abstinence. And they're thinking they're going to do some more research on that. I think that it's good news to know that when you are open and you are clear, teenagers don't totally get it. They don't totally get most things. I mean, just think of when you were a teenager. It takes a time to get the brain working and the body coordinated and where the thought processes work in an organized manner. Those hormones kick in, and the more that you can educate them without fear, educate them on the facts, the more thoughtful they will be. Let's face it, it's been going on since man and woman first were designed, however that ever came about. Just know that it is something that when they do have the education, it does make a difference. I wanted to share with you a quick story here. I know we're coming close to being out of time. This is about a particular family, the Lazy Bee Ranch. There was a 260 square miles of it that lies on the New Mexico and Arizona border. Now, most of it is just scrub brush. It's been that way in this particular family since 1881. Now, there was a couple, Harry and Ada May Day, and when they had their first child, they traveled 200 miles to El Paso for the birth of that baby. Ada May brought her baby girl home to a difficult life. There was only four rooms in the adobe house, no running water, no electricity, and there wasn't a school anywhere close. Now, with that kind of an environment, you would think a little girl's intellectual future might not be very good. But do you know, these parents decided they were going to teach their daughter and teach her well. The mother, Ada May, subscribed to metropolitan newspapers and magazines. She read to her daughter hour after hour. When her little girl was 4 years old, she began her on the Calvert method of homeschooling, and she made sure that her daughter went to the best boarding schools they could afford. And one summer, the parents took all of the children in the family on a car trip to visit all the state capitals west of the Mississippi River. Now, when this young lady was ready for college, she went to Stanford, then on to law school. And eventually, she became the first woman justice to sit on the Supreme Court of the United States of America, Sandra Day O'Connor. Hey, moms and dads out there, you make a difference. Don't ever forget that. And wherever you are, whatever you're doing, don't ever think that you don't have a choice in making your life better. You do. This is Donna Sebo. We're out of time. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Have poetry in your life. Live it with joy, live it with fulfillment, and live it with the meaningful attention of the moment. It makes a difference. Talk with you tomorrow. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.